Now we're going on to a first focused chapter, and it's one that's not all over the place. This is a chapter that's called The Chemical Context of Life, and it's about chemistry, of course, as the name implies, which is appropriate in this course because this is cell biology, and what happens in a cell is chemistry. Life is chemistry. The chemistry as a science, by the way, is immense. It's a huge science, includes a lot of stuff in it. But among the things that chemistry includes is studies of chemical reactions. And that's what the opening slide is portraying an example of using these photographs. We talked a little bit about this in lab. We talked about chemical changes versus physical changes. A chemical reaction causes a chemical change. In a chemical reaction, some number of substances, called reactants, in this case there are two, but it doesn't have to be two, get transformed into some number of products. This happens to have one product, but it can be more than one. How do you know reactants from products? Well, the reactants are on the left side of the arrow, which represents the change. And the products, however many there are on the right side of the arrow. Usually we don't write chemical reactions or chemical reaction equations with pictures. This one happens to. We could do it with chemical formulae of the reactants and products as well, which is what's usually done. But anyway, the point here is that this is a chemical reaction because what you end up with is not the same stuff as what you started with. And this is a pretty stark example of the fact that there is a change in stuff. Because in this example we have, as reactants, sodium and chlorine. Sodium is a very highly reactive metal. It is dangerous stuff. Explosively reactive. Which is why you never want to touch it. This guy has gloves on because even the tiny amount of water on your skin from transpiration will violently react with the sodium metal. So sodium can kill you. Chlorine is also very highly reactive, a toxic gas when it's by itself. Chlorine will kill you. And so you get these two things that can kill you individually together. And without adding or subtracting any material, just getting them together, there will be a rearrangement of the particles that make them up to form sodium chloride. And sodium chloride not only will not kill you, you can't live without it. So that's a really drastic change, right? Between two things that will kill you to something that you can't live without. Without adding any material or taking any material away, it's simply a rearrangement of the particles that are making up these substances. That's a chemical reaction in general. I'll mention that a little bit later. Let's go on to slide two and look at another example of ways to depict chemical reactions. These are also reaction equations, but the top one is cartoon form, showing cartoons of the actual particles involved. So you have hydrogen and oxygen forming water. The reason this is useful is it shows you what I just told you. There aren't any particles added or subtracted. It's the same particles. They're just rearranged. And that rearrangement gives the products completely new properties compared to what the reactants had. The bottom one is the same reaction, it's just using the chemical formulae to depict them, and that's the way you usually see chemical reactions. Slide three is a table that you see is about the human body, but even though the numbers would be slightly different, this really applies to any organism. But it's fine to think about it as humans. First of all, this is a table of elements, so we need to talk about what that is. What is an element? I mean, what makes something an element? As opposed to some other kind of substance. An element is a substance, but there's no limit to the number of substances, and there are new ones being produced all the time. We've already made millions of different substances. But very few of them are actually elements. What is it that makes up an element? I mean, makes something an element? Well, first of all materials, whether they're elements or not, all materials, all matter, is made out of particles called atoms. So that's true for elements and compounds. What distinguishes an element, though, is that it is a substance that is made out of only one kind of atom. However much of that stuff you have, that sample, it's an element if all of the atoms in it are the same kind of atoms. Atoms. Those are just parts of atoms. But we'll get there in a couple minutes. So there's millions already and no limit to the number of substances, but there are only roughly 100 elements in the universe listed on the periodic table of the elements. And they're listed in order of size. So the ones at the top are lighter elements compared to the ones on the bottom. I'll talk in a little bit about how you have different kinds of atoms, but that's what distinguishes an element. It's made up of only one kind of atom. A compound, on the other hand, which is sodium chloride, the product of the reaction we just looked at, it's table salts, the stuff you use today in lab. That is an example of a compound, but any given compound is a compound, and it's called that because two or more different kinds of elements are compounded, put together. Let me just momentarily go back to two. Hydrogen gas naturally is found as two atoms of hydrogen that we call a hydrogen molecule when they're together. That's not a compound because there's two atoms, but they're the same type. Okay, so that's a molecule of an element. This is a molecule of a different element, oxygen, because both of the atoms are the same. But a water molecule is a compound because it has a hydrogen atom and oxygen atom as well. Or two hydrogen atoms and an oxygen atom. All right? So the vast majority of substances in the universe are compounds made out of these relatively few elements in some combination. Well, living things contain mostly the light elements, which are near the top of the periodic table. And for the human body list, for instance, notice this isn't nearly all of the ones that are on the periodic table. In fact, there's a lot of elements on the periodic table that you don't want in your body at all. You'll die. But it's mostly the light ones, and those are listed here. Even those that you do have, most of them are, you don't really need all that much. There are trace elements, for instance, which you can't live without, but you need almost none of. You just need a little bit. Most of your body, and this is true for any given organism, in terms of atoms, most of you of an individual is made up of these four biggies: oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen. Which we'll be talking much more about when we talk about macromolecules eventually coming up. But notice, these four make up almost all of your stuff of your body, 96% for humans. It would be a high number for any given organism, though. All right. Now let's talk about the atoms that I mentioned earlier. This is slide 4. And this is a cartoon of an atom, so it's obviously fictitious in that respect, but there's also a couple other reasons why this is not the truth. But it's a good visual model to think about when you picture atoms. Atoms are almost inconceivably small from our point of view, which is why it takes, you know, a million atoms is still way, way invisible. It takes many, many, many atoms before you can even see that collection of them, which is why we count things that are that small in moles. Right? Remember, we looked at one mole of salt. That's 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd power of particles. That's a lot. So if you divide by that number, that's how big average atoms are. But anyway, an atom, structurally speaking, has two major parts to it. There is a nucleus, but don't confuse that with the other use of nucleus that we've already talked about. A cell nucleus and an atomic nucleus are not only totally different, they are way different in size. We talked about eukaryotic cells before last time, right? Which are ones that have a true nucleus. Well, a cell nucleus, even though it is invisibly small, has millions of atoms in it. So an atomic nucleus is way, way smaller. But anyway, you just have to, from context, understand which of those two we're talking about, because I usually don't say atomic nucleus or cell nucleus. Right now we're talking about atoms, so nucleus means atomic nucleus. But that's one, that really is a necessary part. You don't have an atom if you don't have an atomic nucleus. And then the rest of the atom is the space around it and what it contains. Now, in terms of actual stuff, meaning matter, an atom is made up, even though it's inconceivably small, an atom is made up of even smaller particles, which, because they are smaller than the atom, are called collectively subatomic particles. Subatomic means smaller than an atom. And if this were a physics course instead of a biology course, we would go into the fact that even subatomic particles are made up of even smaller things. Yeah, included, yes. Leptons, there's all kinds of subatomic particles. We're not going to get into that because it's not so important for biology. But we'll stop at the three primary subatomic particle types, all three of which you see in this example. The three subatomic particles are electrons, protons, and neutrons. They're all labeled on this cartoon. Notice that a nucleus, an atomic nucleus, is defined as where you find the protons of an atom, however many there are. Well, there has to be at least one proton, or you don't have an atom. No nucleus has zero protons. That's just known as space. All right? Every atom has one or more protons. In some atoms, in addition to however many protons there are, there is also some number of neutrons. In other words, also in the nucleus, by the way. So, in other words, a nucleus has one or more protons and zero or more neutrons. And one thing that the cartoon gets right is that the size or the mass, which is different from size, the amount of stuff that's in a proton, is almost, not quite, exactly the same as the mass of a neutron. That's why the pink and the brown look the same size here. That nucleus is the only place you find protons and neutrons, if there are any neutrons. Okay? Never outside the nucleus, in other words. That leaves the third category of subatomic particles, which is the electron, Electrons are never found in a nucleus. They're found only in that space outside the nucleus, which is the rest of the atom. Now to the two major reasons why this is not the truth. One is that electrons do not travel around the nucleus in a circle, like this suggests. They also don't go around the nucleus in an elliptical orbit like planets do around a star. When you get down to it, and this is also really beyond the scope of this course, it's impossible actually to tell exactly where an electron is at any one point in time. It's impossible to predict. All we can do is make probabilistic computations as to where it is more likely to be than somewhere else. So this circle, that's false. It's okay to keep that in your mind to remind you that electrons are outside the nucleus, but that's not how they actually move. Another lie, though, is that though there is a size difference between electrons and protons, it is much more drastic than this cartoon suggests. If they were drawn to scale, you wouldn't see the electrons. So they're all tiny from our point of view, but electrons are much, much tinier than either a proton or a neutron. Now, for some more differences between these. I've told you about where they are. Another thing that's important about the subatomic particles is whether or not they have a charge. Well, neutrons are named for the fact that they're neutral electrically. In other words, they do not have a charge. Protons, on the other hand, and electrons are charged subatomic particles. Protons, every proton individually, is positively charged. You see that plus sign on the magenta protons. An electron, on the other hand, is negatively charged. Now, importantly, despite the huge size disparity between a proton and an electron that I've already talked about, the magnitude or the size of their charges is equal. So a tiny, tiny negative electron is negative by just as much as a much huger positive proton is positive. And therefore, if you have one of each, the equal sizes of their opposite charges cancels out. It adds up to zero, in other words. A proton is a positive one charge. An electron, even though much tinier, is a negative one charge. Equal sizes, but in opposite directions. So they cancel each other out if you have one of each, or if you have the same number of each, however many there are. And if that's true, meaning if the number of electrons equals the number of protons in an atom, then the overall atom is not charged. It has an overall charge of zero because however many positives plus the same number of negatives add up to zero. And that's really what we mean when we use the word atom. We don't bother usually to say neutral atom. Atom means there are the same number of electrons and protons. That's why we're calling it an atom. That doesn't have to be true, but when we say atom, that's what we usually mean. Okay. And this brings up another important point about elements. I've already told you that an element is made up of the same kinds of atoms, which implies that there are different kinds of atoms, right? Well, there are different kinds of atoms, but not because they feature different kinds of particles, What I mean by this is that all electrons are the same as each other, all protons are the same as each other, all neutrons are the same as each other, wherever you find them. What makes an atom different from some other kind of atom is not the types of particles, but the numbers of protons, and only protons. The only thing that makes a given atom of an element that element and not some other element is its number of protons. And we give that number, whatever it is, a special name, which is the atomic number. And the periodic table of the elements is an ordered listing of all the elements ordered by atomic number, which in this version of the periodic table is the blue integer in the upper right corner of each box. So hydrogen is the simplest element, simplest atom. And an atom is a hydrogen atom only for one reason. Specifically, that its nucleus contains exactly one proton. If it's zero, you don't have anything. If it's more than one, you don't have hydrogen, you have some other element instead. Helium has two. Its atomic number is two. Two protons. All right, so that's the only thing that makes an element that type of element, the number of protons. But if we're talking about an atom, and therefore a neutral atom of hydrogen, then yes, we have definitely one proton, that makes it hydrogen, but because it's a neutral atom, that means we also have one electron to counteract that proton. All right? Well, I have to admit that I kind of lied to you earlier when I said an element is made up of only one kind of atom. It's true. That's a true statement with respect to number of protons. In other words, a sample of pure lithium, no other kind of element in there at all, pure lithium. Every atom in that sample will have exactly three protons because that's what makes it lithium. But actually, there are different versions of lithium atoms. Not because they differ in their number of protons, but because they can have different numbers of neutrons in there as well. What do we call two elements, two atoms of the same element, but with different number of neutrons? Anyone know? Isotopes, yes. Iso meaning same. So isotopes differ in their number of neutrons, but they're the same element. Okay. Let's go on to 5. This cartoon in B is exactly what we just looked at. I already told you that's not the truth. Well, neither is A, but it's closer to the truth. Obviously, it's still a cartoon. Protons are not really magenta colored. But the reason it's closer to the truth is that the electrons are not depicted as being in defined orbits. You don't actually see any electrons here, right? You just see yellowness. But different shades of yellowness. Notice it fades off. This is what we call the electron cloud, which is really just a probability space. The darker the yellow here, the more probable it is to find an electron there at any given moment in time. And less probable when you get into lighter areas. This reflects the fact that it's impossible to know exactly where it is at any given moment. All right, so however many electrons there are in an atom, they occur in what's called the electron cloud. They're never in the nucleus. All right, now to 6. And this can be confusing. We're about to talk about some spaces that make up that electron cloud. First, it's important to understand that I'm talking about spaces, not material objects. So they're just regions, okay? But what makes it potentially confusing is that I'm going to talk about spaces that contain spaces, and those subspaces contain spaces within them. So spaces within spaces within spaces we're going to talk about. It's a somewhat good analogy would just be considering a house, although the walls are real in this case. In an atom, we don't have real walls. But in a house, you have the overall house. That's a space. And within that, you have smaller spaces called rooms. And then within some of those rooms, you have subspaces called closets. All right. If you ignore the physicality, the materialness of the walls, that's kind of a good analogy about what we're going to talk about. But we'll talk about the biggest spaces first, which are called either energy levels, or sometimes just levels, or electron shells, or just shells sometimes. Those are interchangeable terms. Shells and levels refer to the same thing, and they're just spaces. They don't exist as material. But what this slide 6 shows you is that the energy levels are part of that electron cloud. They're outside of the nucleus. And there are distinct, discrete, separate from each other, levels that are different distances from the nucleus. And levels, or shells, are numbered, starting with 1, which is the closest one to the nucleus. 2, 3, and so on. Oh, I thought that was a question. All right, now, the reason these are called energy levels is that there's different energy associated with the different levels. Electrons occupy these levels. So the levels are spaces, remember. The electrons are actual material. But the point that this particular slide is trying to get across is that any given electron is going to occupy a level. One level or another, not somewhere in between. That's what the ball on the stairs is trying to represent as an analogy. If you let loose of this ball, depending on how you let loose of it, it might land all the way at the bottom. Maybe it'll land on a step. But it's never going to land halfway between, right? So an electron is in one level or another at any given moment. And if it's in, the closer it is to the nucleus, the lower energy it has. And that's, if you let me anthropomorphize or give human traits to an electron, even though they don't have these, an electron prefers to be at a lower level, as low a level as it can occupy. All right? You can see that with these arrows. You can force an electron to go to a higher level, but you have to put energy in to do that. We'll talk about that later when we talk about photosynthesis. But if that happens, that electron wants to fall right back down if it can. It wants to be at the lowest energy level it can occupy. So those are shells or levels. That's the biggest of the three spaces. Now let's go to 7. Within each level, there is some number of subspaces called subshells. I should have said within each shell. The shell is a level, but it makes sense to call subspaces within a shell subshells, right? In other words, a shell or level is made out of subshells, which are also spaces. It's just spaces within the space. That would be like rooms within the house. And each subshell, which is already a space within a space, is made up of spaces within it. And those spaces that are part of and that make up a subshell are individually called orbitals. That would be like the closets within a room within a house. Orbitals make up subshells. Subshells make up levels or shells. Everyone good on all that? Stop me if it's not okay, because it is confusing. Yeah. Yeah, orbitals are the smallest in a sense, spaces. Orbitals make up spaces called subshells, and some number of subshells make up spaces called levels or shells. Okay, now there are different kinds of orbitals that I'll talk about in a minute. But importantly, any individual orbital, regardless of what type it is, one orbital can contain at most 2 electrons. And that means there are 3 possibilities for any given individual orbital. The 3 possibilities are that it has 0 electrons, it's empty. It has 1 electron, half filled. Or it has 2 electrons, full. Right? No other possibilities. Level 1, which is the first level, one closest to the nucleus, is kind of a special case, and it actually makes it even more confusing, at least at first. Level 1, like all levels, is made out of subshells, but in the case of level 1, there is only 1 subshell in that level. A subshell, no matter which level it is in, qualifies as a subshell because it contains all of the orbitals of the same type that are in that level. All right? And so I need to make this hopefully continue to make sense. I need to tell you that there are the 2 kinds of orbitals we care about in this course. There are more than just 2 types. But there are 2 types shown in this cartoon. S orbitals, and you can think of S as standing for spherical, but an S orbital is a spherical-shaped space. And there are 2 of them in this picture. Because there's a small circle here, that's one S, that's the first S orbital, and this one's an S orbital in a different level. Go ahead. Of what? An orbital is a space that an electron can occupy, but an individual single orbital, in other words, can hold at most 2. So it's either going to have 0, 1, or 2 electrons in it. Okay, there are also p-type orbitals, and p-type orbitals are not spherical shaped. They're kind of dumbbell shaped or shaped like an infinity symbol. So this is 1 p-orbital by itself. This is another one. And this is another one. Okay? And there are d-orbitals and f-orbitals, but you'll get into that in chemistry if you take it. So there's different types, though, of orbitals. Well, what I was trying to say a little bit ago is that a subshell is defined as the collection of all the orbitals in that level, but all the orbitals of just one type. Okay? Level 1, though, the overall level, has just 1 subshell in it called the S subshell. And it's called the S subshell because it includes all of the S orbitals in that level. Well, there's... Oh, go ahead.
Can you just repeat the shape of the P orbitals again?
A dumbbell shape or an infinity symbol. Let me say something about S orbitals. Every level, including 1, has its own S orbital. and exactly one of them. Okay? Every level has an S. Starting with level 2, every level 2 and above, in addition to the S, has 3 P orbitals as well. So there aren't any P orbitals found in level 1. But level 2 has its own S orbital plus 3 P orbitals. Okay? Now, in level 1, you have the overall level. You have within it the S subshell, which consists of all the S orbitals in that level. But there's only one of those, as I told you. So in the special case of level 1, the S orbital, the S subshell, and the entire level really are all the same thing. Okay? Level 2, though, has a separate S orbital. It's an S orbital of its own, which, by the way, we specify those with a numeral before the S. The one that's in level 1 is the 1S orbital. The one that's in level 2 is the 2S orbital. Any level has only one S orbital, so the S orbital makes up also the S subshell in that level, because that's all of the orbitals of type S. Following me? But since this is level 2, it also has 3 different P orbitals. And by the way, not only are there 3, but the orbitals are positioned mutually orthogonally, which means each of them is at right angles to the other 2, like the X, Y, and Z axes of a 3-dimensional graph. Go ahead.
So every level minus level 1 is going to have at least 3 P orbitals.
Not at least 3, exactly 3.
Exactly 3, so yeah. Every other level besides 1.
Right, level 3 will also have 3 P's. If you either have no P's, which is only in the case of level 1, or you have 3, exactly. And every level has exactly 1 S orbital.
How do we tell the difference between the P's? Do we even number them like the 1S?
That's what I was just about to say. Since they correspond to X, Y, and Z axes, we specify them. First of all, there are 2 P orbitals if they're in level 2, meaning numeral 2. It's not that there are 2 of them. There are 3 of them, but each one is called a 2 P orbital because it's in level 2. But to distinguish them, we usually write an X, Y, or Z subscript. So there's a 2 P X, a 2 P Y, and a 2PZ. And each of these is at right angles to the other 2. All right? Now, armed with that knowledge, how many levels are we looking at on this figure? No. 2. That's why we have exactly 2 S orbitals. Each level has 1 S orbital in it. Has a single S orbital in it. The smallest one is in level 1, so it's called the 1S orbital. This bigger one is an S orbital that's in level 2, so it's called a 2S orbital. And if we had 3 levels, we would be seeing 3 S orbitals. 3 individual S orbitals. Okay, so there are 2 levels here. Everyone clear on that? Okay, how many subshells do we have here total? Yes, can you name them? Or was it a guess?
No, I think it was 3, but I don't know.
Well, the reason there are 3 is because the first level has an S subshell that contains all of the S orbitals, but there's only 1 of them. Okay, so this is 1 subshell. The orbital and the subshell are the same thing, really. There's another subshell in level 2 called the 2S. I mean, the second level's S subshell, which is really the same thing as that 2S orbital. And there's also in level 2 a P subshell, which consists of all of the P orbitals in that level, which there are 3 of. So all three of these dumbbells belong to the same subshell because they're all P-type orbitals. And therefore, there's three overall, as you said. This one, and this one. All three of those P's in one subshell. All right, and then finally, how many orbitals do we have here? No. We have two categories of orbitals, but how many orbitals?
Six.
Not six. Five. We have an S in level one, and that's the entire level. In level two, we have another S and three P's. So five altogether. One, two, three, four, five. Okay? Go ahead.
Are they called orbitals because that's how they try to interpret the way that...
Yes, that's why they got the name. But it's not a planetary elliptical orbit. It's these shapes really exist. We figured it out mathematically. But when we predict where an electron is, I told you you can't know it, but we know it's somewhere within this shape in space.
They're not random, they do follow.
Right, yeah, they really do have these shapes. They're just not material. And the d orbitals have a different shape still, and so on. All right, now if we go to the next slide, I think it'll make it even more clear. This is the same picture, the one that we see on the bottom, but now we can take it apart. The smallest S, the smallest circle, sphere, is really this, all three spaces in the level are the same thing. The entire level is this sphere. The subshell is that sphere. And the orbital is that sphere. Right? So level one has only one orbital total. Go ahead.
So we can't ever pinpoint an electron in an atom, but because we know how many subshells we know how many electrons are in an atom.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, we know how many there are, just not individually, precisely where they are at any given moment. And don't worry about that in terms of this class. That's not going to matter. It's just, I'm telling you the truth about that. It's not that it's... That's something you need to understand for this course. Okay, now next level is the bigger black box. That's the entire level, level two. That space includes two subshells, an S subshell and a P subshell. Right? They're subshells because each subshell contains all of the orbitals of the same type. The S subshell contains the only S orbital that's in that level. And the P subshell contains all three P orbitals. For a total of, for this whole atom, a total of three subshells like we talked about. One, two, and three. But in terms of orbital, the second level includes four overall orbitals, a single S and three different P's. Okay, now, from what I've told you so far, how many electrons can be contained in level two? Eight. Can you say why? Well, yeah, you can cheat and look. But explain it.
Each orbital contains two electrons max.
Exactly. And there are four orbitals in that level, right? So you can't fit more than eight electrons in level two. How many can you fit in level one?
Two.
Two at most. Yes. All right, now look back at the periodic table. Periodic means repeating. By the way, it's a table, obviously, and tables have rows and columns, but we don't call them rows and columns for the periodic table, even though they are. The rows are called periods. and the columns are called groups. Elements that are in the same group have very similar chemical characteristics. Periods, on the other hand, the rows, correspond to levels, shells. Notice on the right, on the left edge, they are numbered. So this first row is the first level. Well, how many elements do we find in period one? Two. Why two? That's what they are, but why are there only two? There are other periods with more numbers of elements in them.
Because the level is completely filled, so we have to move on to the next one.
Completely filled with what?
Electrons.
Exactly. Okay, consider hydrogen, the simplest atom. There's only one thing that makes it hydrogen, again. That's the fact that it has exactly one proton. But we're talking about a neutral atom of hydrogen, and therefore it also has one electron. That's what makes it an overall charge of zero, a positive and a negative. Okay? That one electron will fit in the only orbital that's in that level, the 1s orbital, so there's no problem. Helium is helium because it has two protons, but it also has two electrons if it's neutral. Once again, that same orbital, the only orbital that's in that level, can hold that second electron. But then you get to lithium, which has three protons, and therefore three electrons. And that third electron cannot fit in the first level because the overall level has only one orbital in it, and an orbital can't hold more than two. All right? So that third electron has to occupy, even though it doesn't really want to, a higher energy level, a higher shell. Shell 2. Okay? Well, notice there's eight elements in the second period. That corresponds to the fact that second level includes four orbitals, and therefore can hold at most eight electrons. Neon is element number 10 because it has 10 protons. That means it has 10 electrons. Well, two of those electrons completely fill level 1, just like helium. But then you have 8 more electrons to make up the rest of the 10, and those other 8 completely fill up the second level. That's why you're at the end of the period. Can't fit any more electrons. And that fact, namely that the outer electron shell is full, gives neon a special degree of stability. Remember I said that things that are in the same group or column are similar? Neon is right on the right edge of the periodic table, and so are all the other ones in that same group. Hydrogen, neon, argon, krypton, xenon, and so on. Those collectively are called the noble gases. And the inert gases, or the noble gases, yes. And they're inert, which means they don't react with things, because they are nice and happy. They are stable because they have a full outer shell. All right? Now, I'll talk more about that in a minute, but this brings up some more definitions. I need to give you three definitions that use the word valence, so this is potentially confusing as well, since the same word is used different ways. Well, levels or shells are just spaces, right? They exist, 1, 2, 3, and up. But if a shell is completely empty, no electrons in it at all, though it's there, we don't really consider it. So there's there's some number of levels in any given atom that have at least one electron in them. The lower levels fill up, and when they can't hold any more, then you have to put the other elements in a higher level. But in any given atom, there is some level that is the outermost level having at least one electron in it. In other words, there's an outermost non-empty level. And that is called the valence shell. So that's one use of this word. All right? Now we can also use the word in the phrase number of valence electrons, which is simply the number of electrons that are found in the valence shell. All right? That's pretty straightforward, but that's a different definition with that same word in it. And the third one is just the word by itself, valence. If we talk about an atom's valence, which is different from its number of valence electrons, definitionally, the valence of an atom is the number of additional electrons you would have to give that atom in order to fill up its valence shell. All right? Now let's consider hydrogen again. First of all, what is hydrogen's valence shell? Level 1 is its valence shell. What is the number of valence electrons? Also 1. It has one electron to counteract its one proton that makes it hydrogen. And that one electron that it has is in the outermost shell that has an electron in it. So there's one valence electron. What is hydrogen's valence? Also 1, coincidentally. It's 1 because for level 1, 2 is completely full, right? And therefore the valence is 1 because you have to add another 1 to the one it has in order to make its valence shell full. Let's think, though, about nitrogen, number 7. What is its valence shell? Level 2. The number of valence electrons for nitrogen? Yeah.
Does it have negative 3 charge, so these 5 now?
It has 5, yeah. Five. Now, it has 7 overall electrons. But 2 of those are in the lower level that's already full. That's not a valence shell. The valence shell is the outermost one that has an electron in it. So shell 2 is the valence shell, and there are the other 5 to make up the total of 7. The other 5 are in shell 2, and therefore there are 5 valence electrons. You can tell that because nitrogen is 5 steps from the left edge in the period. What is the valence of nitrogen? It is 3 because level 2, since it has 4 orbitals, is able to hold 8 electrons, not just 2 like level 1. And therefore, you'd have to add 3 more to the 5 that are in the valence shell of nitrogen to fill up that second level. Therefore, its valence is 3. And you can tell that by noticing that it's 3 steps from the right. Well, a couple things to say about valence. Or valence shells and valence electrons, really. It's important to chemical reactions. As I was talking about when we started, chemical reactions occur because of a rearrangement of particles. When two atoms react, they first have to encounter each other. And thinking about what we've already talked about as far as the structure of atoms, notice that it's not atomic nuclei that come into contact. They're in the core, right? They're buried deep. What comes into contact when two atoms encounter each other are not only electrons, but specifically the outermost, or valence electrons. That's why that's so important. Another thing, though, goes back to what I was saying about the stability of having an outer or valence shell that's full. That's true of all the noble gases. That's why they are content. They don't undergo reactions under normal circumstances, even with other atoms of the same type. They exist in nature just as single atoms, not as molecules. But chemistry, the various chemical reactions, really happen because all of the other atoms that are not completely satisfied like the noble gases are trying to get into a situation that is like one of the noble gases. They're trying, in other words, to satisfy their valence. They're trying to get into a situation where their outer shell is full. And that's the reason chemical reactions happen the way they do. The rearrangement is such that they become more stable because of their full shells. Yeah.
Do the atoms look for other atoms to be stable?
Well, they don't. No atom is looking for anything. They just encounter each other. But when they do, if the situation is correct, then there will be a reaction, and that will increase the stability. Yeah. Yes, yes, that's a good observation. And as I go on, that'll become more clear, hopefully, to everyone else. Slide 9 is just basically the top part of this periodic table, the part that's most important to biology, because these are the lighter elements that organisms are made out of, mostly. And the only information that you see on here that you don't on the real periodic table on the wall is that you have cartoons of the electron cloud. It's not drawn as a cloud, it's that fly, that, like I said. But you don't see any detail in the nucleus. There are however many protons and neutrons in there. The electrons, though, are drawn as dots in circles. What does an individual circle represent? A shell, right. Not an orbital. You should know that it can't be an orbital because there are some circles that have more than two electrons in them, which is impossible for an orbital, right? So a circle represents a shell. That's why all the ones that are in period 2, which represents the second level or shell, have two circles. Notice, though, that in those shells, for some atoms with multiple electrons, some of the electrons are paired up close to each other and some are not. What does a paired up a pair of electrons tell you? They are in the same orbital, yes. The ones that are by themselves are half filling their own orbitals. Okay, so hopefully that just makes what I've said more sense. Now we can go on to 10. When do we stop? 3:15? Now it's time to talk about bonds. There are many different kinds of bonds, but only some of those types of bonds are classified as chemical bonds. We'll talk about some non-chemical bonds later. But what makes a bond a chemical bond, if it is that the formation of that bond produces new substance. It's not just a matter of things sticking together a chemical bond actually makes a new material.
So like the sodium and chloride?
Right. When the sodium and the chlorine react, there's bonds that form between the atoms of the sodium and the chlorine, such that when you have those bonds form, you now don't have sodium or chlorine anymore. You have the compound sodium chloride, table salt. New stuff with new properties. All right? So that's in general what a chemical bond is. So another way of saying that is that in any given chemical reaction, certain bonds are broken and new chemical bonds are formed, which is why you have new stuff. Yeah?
Would covalent bonds count as chemical bonds?
Yes, that's where I'm headed. So chemical bonds is a category by itself. It's not all bonds, but it's all the bonds that change the stuff. Within that set of chemical bonds, there's more than two, but we're going to talk about two major kinds of chemical bonds, major categories. And those are ionic bonds and covalent bonds. They're both chemical bonds, but they differ in important respects. We'll start, since this is the slide I'm on, with ionic bonds. Obviously, based on the word, ionic bonds involve ions. So we need to define formally what an ion is. Be careful with that because it's an I word, just like isotope, but those are totally different things. Isotopes are atoms of the same element, but that differ in their number of neutrons. Notice I didn't say anything at all about electrons in that definition. Ions are atoms or particles. It could be atoms or molecules. They are particles with an overall charge. Remember, I said that when we use the word atom by itself, usually what we really mean is neutral atom, and therefore no overall charge. There's only one way for that to be possible, specifically to have the same number of electrons as there are protons. That's the only way you can add up to zero, in other words, right? To have a neutral atom. But that doesn't have to be the case. That's just, if it is the case, then we use the word atom. If it's not the case, then we, in other words, if it's not true that the number of electrons equals the number of protons, then we don't usually call it an atom, we call it an ion instead. Because there is an overall charge. It adds up to something other than zero. Now, when you think about this, based on your knowledge of protons and electrons and how the charges are, there's four ways you could produce an ion. Just when you think about it, not in reality. But there's four ways you could get to a non-zero sum of charges. You could do that by either adding protons, by taking protons away, by adding electrons, or by taking electrons away. Any one of those four things would change the overall charge, right? That is true, but that's not all four of those are what happen. You don't form ions by changing the number of protons. If you change the number of protons, you no longer have the same element, right? Because the element is defined by the number of protons. So in ordinary chemical reactions, the number of protons is not changed. Remember that they're in the nucleus, those are the cores, they're not involved in chemistry. Chemistry involves the electrons being rearranged. So ions are formed either by an atom taking on additional electrons or an atom losing electrons. Either one of those things will change the overall charge from zero to some value. What happens to the value if you take away electrons? It becomes positive, the sum, right? Because you still have the same number of positive protons, but now you have fewer than that number of electrons, or negatives, to counteract that number of positives. So taking away negative electrons is mathematically the same as subtracting a negative number, right? Which is like adding a positive number. So positive ions are formed by loss of electrons. And exactly the opposite if you take on additional electrons. If you take on additional electrons, you are adding more negatives than you have positives, and therefore the sum is negative number. Those are negatively charged ions. Obviously, I have to stop there, but we'll continue.